1. Shi'ism and the Safavid Revolution, 1501-1588. In March 1501, Ismail, a 15-year-old descendant from the House of Safavi in the Iranian Azerbaijan, declared himself the King of Kings and the founder of a new Shi'i state that came to be known as the Safavid Dynasty. Shortly after his accession in Tabriz, the new Shah, who entertained wild messianic claims, ordered that all mosques in his realm recite the Shi'i version of the Islamic call to prayer. The additional phrase in this version, "I witness that Ali is God's friend, Wali Allah," was meant to demonstrate the legitimate authority, velayat, of Ali, the first Shi'i imam, and that of his progeny. This was the first time since the 11th century that a Shi'i call to prayer had been heard from the minarets of an Islamic state. A royal decree issued by Ismail also required his subjects to publicly curse the rightly guided caliphs of the early Islamic era. Whoever disobeys, he is to be beheaded. Ismail's anti-Sunni audacity was complemented not only by bold practices of the Turkmen warrior clans in his service, but also by his patronage of Arab Shi'i jurists who were invited to his kingdom, first from northern Syria and later from southern Iraq and the Arabian Peninsula. The historian Hassane Rumlu, a near contemporary of Ismail's, notes that at first, even the basics of the Shi'i law were not known, nor were the rules and rituals of the rightful Twelver Shi'i sect. Until then, to most people in Iran, save for pockets in Khorasan, Gilan, and central Iran, Shi'ism often meant reverence for the house of the Prophet rather than a belief system presided over by Shi'i jurists. A new axial age. The rise of the Safavid state and assertion of Shi'ism as religion of the realm at the outset of the 16th century, corresponding to the turn of the 10th Islamic century, was a turning point not only for Iran proper, but also for the predominantly Sunni neighboring lands. Since its inception, Shi'ism has been imbued with a cult of suffering and martyrdom. It also has prompted numerous messianic movements with crucial roles in the shaping of Islamic history. The Safavid movement and the brand of Twelver Shi'ism it came to promote were the end result of one such messianic process. Twelver Shi'ism upheld the belief that the direct line of succession of 12 imams from the House of Ali is the sole source of legitimate authority in Islam. The last of these imams, according to Twelver Shi'is, is the Mahdi, who is the Lord of the time. He is currently in the state of occultation, but will return to earth at the end of time. The Safavid Empire, moreover, came to represent the focal point of a wide geographical span of Shi'i communities that stretched from tip of the Indian subcontinent to the eastern shores of the Mediterranean. Since the middle of the 14th century, the Safavid movement had preserved an embattled enclave in Azerbaijan and eastern Anatolia, despite many military and ideological challenges. Once in power, however, the movement impressed on its subjects a new Shi'i identity and nurtured an imperial state on which Iran's political sovereignty would come to rest. Ruthless and unwavering, though Ismail and his successors were, the Safavids brought, in a relatively short span of time, a degree of conformity to an otherwise disparate mosaic of local dynasties, ethnicities, and cultures that had divided Iran since Timur's time a century earlier. The Safavids thus reconstituted the guarded domains of Iran. They patronized a refined Persian material culture and helped articulate a tradition of Islamic philosophy and theology. They established diplomatic and commercial ties with Europe and facilitated Iran's earliest encounters with Western modernity. Safavid Iran did not emerge in geographical or political isolation, but was very much part of a process that transformed the world, regionally and globally, in early modern times, an age marked by new religious impulses, broadened geographical horizons, shifts in the accumulation of wealth, technological breakthroughs, and new thinking about humanity. In the latter part of the 15th century, the heartland of Islam, between the Nile and the Oxus, Amu Darya, witnessed the establishment of a new politico-religious system comprising four imperial powers, The Ottoman Empire, encompassing Anatolia and the Balkans, and later the Eastern Mediterranean and North Africa, the Safavid Empire from Azerbaijan and the Caucasus to the Persian Gulf and Greater Khorasan, the Mughal Empire, dominating the Indian subcontinent from Sindh and Punjab in the west to Kashmir in the north, Bengal in the east, and Deccan in the south, and the Uzbek Confederacy of Central Asia that dominated old centres of Islamic civilization such as Samarkand and Bukhara. The Gunpowder Empires, as these conquering and quarrelling powers were called because of their increasing use of firearms for conquest and control, were indeed Persianate empires. They were organized around the ancient Perso-Islamic model of government and remained within the parameters of Persian language and culture, at least before the rise of Turkish vernacular in the Ottoman Empire and Urdu and Hindi in the Mughal world. These imperial systems also shared among themselves, and with the Europe of their time, some rudiments of modernity. Territorially, they were tied to relatively well-defined boundaries. They sponsored and often enforced a religious creed. Their armies enjoyed great firepower, and their agrarian economies began to be affected by a new world system of long-distance trade, overseas and transoceanic contacts, and monetary trends. Changes within these empires were in line with revolutionary changes in the world at large. The 70-year span between the Ottoman conquest of Constantinople in 1453 and the Mughal conquest of northern India in 1526 coincided with at least four major global processes: the voyages of discovery and expansion of commercial maritime empires in both the eastern and the western hemispheres, and the colonization of the Americas; the shaping of European empire and nation-states with expansionist ambitions; and the High Renaissance in Central and Southern Europe, as well as the Age of Reformation and Counter-Reformation. The Muslim empires of this period, similar to the Chinese, Malay, and Japanese societies to the east, were in a transitional stage that combined old patterns of socio-economic organization and the values of a time-honored culture with new modes of legitimacy and new means of technology. With some degree of historical latitude, the state-sponsored Shi'ism that came about with the rise of the Safavids can be compared to the Reformation in northern and central Europe, and the Sunni reaction to it with the Counter-Reformation. The ensuing schism between the Sunnis and the Shi'is recalls the Protestant-Catholic cleavage that hastened the shaping of the European nation-states. The artistic and literary efflorescence that first came about, especially in Herat, but also in Samarkand and Tabriz, was as significant for the Islamic world as the Italian and German Renaissance was for European culture. The military technology that began to change the shape of Muslim domains, from Bosnia to Bengal, was no less palpable than the impact of the same technology in Europe or Japan. Despite such parallels, however, the process of change in Muslim societies did not follow the European pattern and should not be studied as if it did. Though chronologically parallel and equally as revolutionary, and no doubt interconnected, the potential for change in these societies brought about different results. The Safavids' hostile political and ideological relations with the Ottomans, in turn, made Iran's access to the Mediterranean limited and haphazard. Both empires, Safavid and Ottoman, remained essentially introverted and unable to seriously engage with new trends that rapidly were changing Europe of the 17th and 18th centuries. From a mystical order to a messianic revolt. Within Iran, the Safavids' rise to power was the outcome of nearly three centuries of upheavals since the Mongol invasion of the early 13th century. More specifically, it was the result of a prolonged period of instability following the demise of the vast Timurid Empire in the second part of the 15th century. Despite a short-lived recovery and outburst of cultural brilliance, the Persianate world of the 15th century was weakened, at times devastated, and experienced more ethnic divisions than it had before. Politically, it had almost completely fragmented into quarrelling principalities and unstable city-states. Ismail's rise to power was the culmination of more than two centuries of struggle within the House of Safavi, first for religious authority and then for political power in Azerbaijan and neighbouring lands. The Safavid beginnings were rather tragic. Ismail's grandfather, father and older brother, all met their death on the battlefield, fighting crusade-like campaigns in the Caucasus against the Christian population whom they branded as infidels. These campaigns promised them booty, slaves, and territory. Their enemies saw these leaders of the Safavi Sufi order as nothing more than fanatics with dangerous political ambitions. To their semi-nomadic Turkmen devotees, who gradually gathered around them from neighbouring lands, these lords of Ardabil were saints who had been martyred for a divine cause. The Safavi house originally was among the landowning nobility of Kurdish origin, with affinity to the Ahle Hag in Kurdistan. In the 12th century, the family settled in northeastern Azerbaijan, where Safi ad-Din Ardabili died 1334, the patriarch of the Safavid house and Ismail's ancestor, dating back six generations, was a revered Sufi leader. He had founded the Safavi suborder, which was still Sunni, composed mystical poetry in the old Azari dialect, amassed great wealth, and enjoyed the respect of rulers and ministers of his time. He lived in an age when Sufi orders enjoyed great popularity because they offered a form of religion more personal and intimate than the Sharia-oriented religion of the jurists and theologians. The Safavi order thrived not only because it attracted peasants and city dwellers around Ardabil and the Western Caspian, but also because, under Sheikh Safi's successors, Safavi missionaries in neighbouring Anatolia, today's eastern Turkey, and Upper Mesopotamia, today's northern Iraq, converted many Turkmen nomads to the order. As early as the mid-14th century, the tomb of Safi ad-Din Ardabili was a prominent site of Sufi veneration. By the 15th century, the Safavid Sufis, who up to then were moderate Sunnis, had transformed significantly. The order adopted a form of Shiism with messianic proclivities and increasingly became a crusading force with overt political ambitions. The shift was no doubt coloured by the heresies indigenous to the region, but it also aimed to fill the yawning political vacuum in western Iran. Economically, the area under the Safavids' fragile control in Azerbaijan was significant because it encompassed trade routes from the Caspian Sea to Tabriz, and further northwest to the trading centres of the Black Sea and the Eastern Mediterranean. To the political masters of the region, the regular passage of the caravan trade meant prosperity and power. To the west of the rising Safavids, who were still a small Sufi enclave, other mighty powers were in control of the neighbouring lands. The Ottoman Turks were expanding both west and east with a crusading zeal similar to that of the Safavids. Their exploits were not restricted to Christian lands in the Balkans. They extended also to the waning principalities of Anatolia. Further toward the east, the rapidly declining Timurid Empire, with Tabriz as its western capital, had already fallen two Turkmen dynasties. First, the Shi'i Gara Gyunlu, Black Sheep, 1380 to 1468, and then the powerful Sunni Ag Gyunlu, White Sheep, 1478 to 1501. Despite their nomadic origins, these Turkmen dynasties upheld a strong Persian tradition of kingship and court culture, as did most Anatolian principalities devoured by the Ottomans in the course of the 15th century. The Ag Gyunlu, in particular, transmitted much of these Persianate administrative and courtly features to the rising Safavids. To the southwest of the Ag Gyunlu were the Burji Mamluks of Egypt and Syria, 1382 to 1517. As the bastion of Sunni orthodoxy, the Mamluks were in control of the eastern Mediterranean coast, but they were unwilling to penetrate deep into the Syrian interiors or farther north to confront Ottoman military might head to head, and probably incapable of doing so. The temporary political vacuum, lasting for more than half a century, was ideal for new empire builders in western Iran. A formidable contender was the founder of the previously mentioned Ag Gyunlu dynasty, Hasan Beg, better known as Uzun Hasan, Tall Hasan, presumably because of his physique, reigned 1453 to 1478. He managed to reconquer most of the western Timurid territories and, for a while, returned tranquility to the land. He was a prototype, militarily and politically, for the forthcoming Safavid venture. The advancing Ottomans were not the only concern of Uzun Hasan. As early as 1457, mindful of the rising influence of the Safavi order, he exiled the leadership from Ardabil and tried to restrain it both through coercion and through establishing marital unions. Ismail's ancestry illustrates how such marital alliances bore fruits beyond Uzun Hasan's intent. Ismail's grandfather, Sheikh Jonaid, who for years was a hostage in the Ag Kayunlu court in Tabriz, was married to Uzun Hasan's sister. Later, Sheikh Haydar, Jonaid's son and Ismail's father, married in 1472 Uzun Hasan's daughter Halimeh, also known by her Christian name Martha. She was born to Uzun Hasan's Greek Orthodox wife, a princess named Theodora Despina Khatun, the daughter of John IV, the penultimate ruler of the Greek house of Megas Komnenos of Trebizond, today's Trebizond, after the Latin Crusaders' conquest of Constantinople. Marriage alliances with Uzun Hasan and with a number of Muslim dynasties, however, did not save Trebizond from the Ottoman advances. By 1461, Muhammad II, Mehmet the Conqueror, had conquered the kingdom, and the last of its rulers, a relative of Ismail, and his royal family were captured and sent off to Constantinople. 2 years later, the family was beheaded by order of the Ottoman Sultan for their alleged secret communication with Uzun Hasan. What made the Safavid order especially potent, as Uzun Hasan's successors soon realized, was its combined mystical and military appeal to the Turkmen warriors of the region, who flocked to the Safavi lords of Ardabil once pressure from Ottoman expansion proved unbearable. Organized into a Turkmen confederacy, possibly as early as the 1480s, the Gazilbash, Turkish for the Red Heads, as their enemies first called them, were the backbone of the Safavid fighting force. Organized along tribal lines, both real and invented, their chief function was to launch raids into the interiors of the Caucasus, and most significantly to Georgia, Gurdistan, to plunder and capture Christian slaves. The 12-folded cap made of red fabric was a distinct marker of the Kazilbash. It was adopted by Ismail's father and presumably symbolized devotion to 12-air Shiism. In reality, more than anything else, the headgear symbolized devotion to the Safavi leaders, who by the middle of the 15th century had begun to refer to themselves with the royal title Shah. The beliefs and practices of the Kazilbash were far removed from the mainstream 12-air Shiism and much closer to the unorthodox beliefs of northwestern Iran and eastern Anatolia. Generally labelled as gulat, religious exaggerators, reverence for Ali, the first Shi'i imam, was at the core of the religion of Ahle Hag, prevalent among the Kurdish Turkmen Yazidi, originally known as Izzadis, and other inhabitants of the region. The diffuse creed of the Gazilbash included non-Islamic folklore ranging from crypto-Zoroastrian beliefs to shamanistic practices, the latter a relic of a distant pagan Turkmen past in their Central Asian homeland. What was remarkable about these non-orthodox trends in the borderlands was a dormant form of messianism, one untouched by the strictures of urban Islam. Notions of divine inspiration and reincarnation were not uncommon, and the perfect guide, Murshid-e-Kamel, as the Kazilbash called their Safavid master, was viewed not only as the reincarnation of Ali, but also as a manifestation of the divine in human form. The potentials for such deep loyalties were immense. As it turned out, the heretical extremism of the Safavi order, as its opponent saw it, would successfully channel an amorphous, nomadic mass of followers into a powerful military force. The Gazilbash followers of Ismail, a mix of nomadic refugees who had lost their pasture lands and their way of life to the advancing Ottoman armies, had enigmatic origins. The name of the tribes of the Gazilbash Confederacy derived from regions they considered to be their homeland. The Rumlu presumably came from Rum, or Anatolia, as Muslims identified the former Byzantine province, the Shamlu from Sham, or Syria, the Takkelu from the Takke in the northeast corner of the Mediterranean, the Astajlu from Astaj in the southern Caucasus. Others, such as the Qajar and the Afshar, were named after regions in Azerbaijan or after their presumed tribal ancestors. In the early 16th century, there were seven major tribes of the Qazilbash, all of whom shared a nomadic or semi-nomadic lifestyle, the Turkish language, a messianic faith, and hatred of the Ottomans. Each tribe was made up of numerous clans and subclans who better reflected the ethnic composition of the Qazilbash. A charismatic and ambitious young man, Ismail epitomized the revolutionary process that propelled him into the dual position of a Persian Shah and a Sufi master. In 1498, when he came out of hiding in the Caspian town of Lahijan to begin his long-awaited revolt, his chances did not seem better than those of his slain predecessors. Yet his capture of Erzincan in eastern Anatolia, where his grandfather Uzun Hasan had been defeated by the Ottomans in 1473, and soon after his advances in Azerbaijan and the Caucasus against many local contenders, promised something different. Even though he was still in his teens, to his senior followers, who had hosted him while in Lahijan hiding, Ismail appeared to be a sacred leader who had come to avenge the martyrdom of his forefathers and deliver worldly blessings of land, flocks, and slaves to the Qazilbash. There was more to Ismail's claim to power than just his illustrious Sufi ancestry. As a grandson of Uzun Hasan, he saw himself as a legitimate heir to his throne and with an agenda to reconquer what had been lost by Hasan's successors. He must have also been aware of his royal Greek descent through his mother, Martha. His ill feelings toward the Ottomans were deepened not only by the memory of Uzun Hasan's decisive defeat at the hand of Muhammad the Conqueror, but also by the terrible fate of his maternal granduncle and other relatives. To a mix of Turkmen messianism and ancestral claims, Ismail added a third element of Twelver Shi'ism. While still in hiding in Lahijan, an old Shi'i stronghold in Gilan province, some local dignitaries instructed him in the rudiments of Twelver doctrine. As it turned out, Ismail himself was not particularly keen on practicing the Twelver, or Jafari law. But it was this brand of Shi'ism that he came to promote with zeal throughout his reign. It could be argued that the sacred kingship he represented, a union between Persian kingship and messianic Shi'ism, could be accomplished only by the promotion of Shi'i Sharia. It is no accident that despite the haphazard beginnings of Safavid rule, Ismail's Twelver conviction and its enforcement as the state creed by persuasion and by force, remained an unflinching commitment. Although at first glance it may seem that at the age of 15 Ismail was no more than a puppet of the Qazilbash elite, and no doubt they did exert great influence on him, it was apparently his own commitment to Twelver Shi'ism, against the advice of his Qazilbash chiefs, that persuaded him to convert the predominantly Sunni population of his expanding empire. Building a Shi'i state. In the first decade after his accession, between 1501 and 1511, Ismail conquered nearly all of Uzun Hasan's empire and more. In a series of brilliant campaigns marked by his personal valor and devotion of the Qazilbash irregular forces, he annexed close to 17 semi-autonomous and autonomous principalities, city-states, and local dynasties. The conquered territory stretched from Diyarbakir in eastern Anatolia, a stronghold for the Qazilbash, to the Shirvanshah Kingdom of the southern Caucasus, and from Azerbaijan and Kurdistan to the western Iranian provinces, known as Persian Iraq. Soon Isfahan, Shiraz, Yazd, Kerman, and Khuzestan in central and southern Iran, even as far south as the shores of the Persian Gulf, were annexed to the nascent empire. At the outset of his reign, Ismail adopted distinct strategies to consolidate and to convert. He consciously aimed to create not only a Shi'i state, but also a Shi'i society. In waging war against his many rivals, both to the east and to the west, his method of conquest involved terror and coercion, perhaps more out of expediency than faith, and promotion of the Shi'i Sharia by appointing clerical representatives to the newly conquered territories. Praising Ali, the first imam, and his house and cursing the first three caliphs of early Islam from the pulpit of the mosques as well as in the streets, Safavid itinerant propagandists, known as the denouncers, demanded that their terrified audiences respond to their anti-Sunni curses by uttering the words, "More upon them and no less." The exercise of denouncing, complemented by affirming loyalty to Ali and his house, was commonplace. The affirmation also included defaming some of the companions of the Prophet, as well as slandering Aisha, the Prophet's favourite wife, for her opposition to Ali. Any public resistance met with grave retributions. In Tabriz, where there was initial resistance to the Safavids' forced conversion, thousands of Sunnis, perhaps as many as 20,000, were massacred. If this was meant to be a horrifying example for Sunnis in other cities, it was effective, for, with very few exceptions, the general public, mostly belonging to the Sunni Shafi'i school, complied once their Sunni religious leadership was sufficiently intimidated or, more often, eliminated. In Isfahan and Shiraz, which both fell to the Safavids in 1503, Ismail executed a number of resisting Sunni dignitaries, judges, and preachers. In Baghdad, which was conquered by Ismail in 1508, the members of the local ruling dynasty and their supporting Sunni elite were executed, and the shrine of Abu Hanifa, the 8th-century Sunni jurist and founder of the Hanafi school of law, was desecrated and destroyed. On his way back through Haveza, on the banks of Shatt al-Arab, Ismail defeated the house of Mushashah, a local dynasty with its own messianic claims, and massacred the ruling elite. In at least two mountain fortresses in Mozandaran province, which fell to the Ghazil Bash army in 1504, Ismail reportedly ordered the massacre of the entire population, perhaps in vengeance for their stiff resistance. In the same campaign, after the capture of the fortress of Usta in the central Elburz range, where Marhad Beg Bayanduri, the last of the Ug Koyunlu princes and a blood relative of Ismail, had taken refuge, the Safavid conqueror ordered his wild Ghazil Bash devotees to broil the prince alive and devour him. Upon defeating the local Persian dynasty of Shirvan in the lower Caucasus, against whom Ismail's father and grandfather both had fought and died, he massacred the ruling family and exhumed and burned the bodies of their ancestors, a practice he believed would deprive them of final redemption. The Shirvan Shahids, a local Persian dynasty whose rule dated to the middle of the 9th century, controlled a strategic crossroads in the southeastern Caucasus and prospered from the region's silk trade. Ismail's ferocity and the atrocities committed by his unruly Ghazil Bash hordes were followed soon after by a systematic and enduring program of Shi'i indoctrination. For this, Ismail and his advisers found willing allies and ideological commissars among the Shi'i jurists of Jabali Amil in southern Lebanon. The Shi'i scholars, who long had been persecuted in their homeland by the Mamluk rulers and later by the Ottomans, found in Ismail an ideal patron, and in Safavid Iran a refuge for a life of respect and privilege. The enduring symbiosis between the Safavids and the Arab jurists, who began to arrive by the dozens at the court of Ismail and his successors, was beneficial to both. Unlike the indigenous Shi'i ulama of Iran, or those Sunni jurists and dignitaries who, under duress or to protect their privileges, had converted to Shi'ism, the Arab jurists were newcomers to the Iranian scene, had no knowledge of Persian, and the customs and traditions of their host country were alien to them. Thus, they could not easily build a network of local loyalties independent of the Safavid state. The loyalty of the Jabali Amil ulama to the Safavid state also served the Ghazil Bash chiefs, for they were adapted even less than the Arab jurists to their new Iranian environment. They could barely converse in Persian, if at all, and could scarcely trust or even tolerate the rising Iranian element in the Safavid court and administration, let alone the diverse Iranian public in the remote provinces to which they were assigned as military governors. The Tajiks, from the Persian Tazi, alien, as the invading Ghazil Bash labelled the indigenous Persian population, posed a serious threat to both the Turkmen and the Arab elements, a competition that affected every aspect of government and society for at least a century. Ismail's method of conquest, moreover, allowed the Ghazil Bash to occupy a position of influence in the newly emerging Safavid state. In the patterns of Turkmen tribes, many settled in the newly conquered territories as a military force and a new landowning class. Yet even at the outset of his reign, the young Shah was well aware of the need not only for a centralized state administration, but also for a balancing of the major three ethnic groups in his service. He relied on the small Ghazil Bash clique, known as the Sufis of Lahijan, to hold a number of important high offices. He appointed a regent, Vakil, to oversee the affairs of the state. Ismail himself had a noticeable aversion to administrative duties, even though he possessed innate political insights. The Vakil also occupied a powerful military position as commander-in-chief of the Safavid army. That this powerful office should first be assigned to Ismaili's Ghazil Bash childhood tutor from the Lahijan circle was not surprising. Another Ghazil Bash was also assigned to the sensitive office of Khalifa Tal Khalafa, Caliph of the Caliphs, or Chief of the Deputies, to oversee maintenance of spiritual ties with the Shah, their emblematic perfect guide, through a network of agents in each Ghazil Bash division. The post combined ideological oversight at home, as well as acting as a kind of agent provocateur, especially in the Ottoman territories. Yet the Ghazil Bash's unfamiliarity with the state administration, Divan, soon convinced Ismail of the need for a division of power. Parallel to the office of the Vakil, he appointed Shams al-Din from Lahijan, his own Persian teacher, to the office of Sadr, literally heart, with full authority over the religious affairs of the state. The Sadr was responsible for all clerical and judicial appointments, charitable endowments, or ghaf, and, most critically, the conversion of the general public to 12-air Shi'ism. At the same time, Ismail appointed another former Persian guard of his as vizier, to head, among other tasks, accounting and collection of taxes. In due course, the power of the Ghazil Bash was further checked and eventually subdued as the Shah tilted further toward a succession of Persian officials. In 1508, he appointed to the office of Vakil Najmuddin Rashti, a goldsmith from Rasht and an old companion of Ismail. He may have financed Ismail's early rise to power. The ascendance of Najma gave the office of the Vakil the kind of authority associated with that of the chief minister in the Persian model of government, while the religious affairs remained under the Sadr, another Persian official. Under Najma's successor, a business-savvy Persian from Isfahan known as Najma II, the office of the Vakil gained greater prominence. To the dislike of the Ghazil Bash chiefs, Najma II even led the Safavid forces in military campaigns. The Turkmen-Tajik tension that flared up periodically during and after Ismail's reign also involved the jurists from Jabali Amil. But no matter how eagerly the Ghazil Bash chiefs and the Arab ulama resisted the indigenous Persian element's rise to prominence, they could not evade the dictates of a transforming state. The paradigm shift from a messianic crusade to a bureaucratic state appeared inevitable. The shift did not happen overnight, yet Ismail managed to strike a fragile equilibrium among the restive Ghazil Bash and their Persian rivals. To be sure, Ismail felt deeply indebted to the Ghazil Bash and had to grant them booty and pasture land. He was obliged to assign provincial and district governorships to them as tenured fiefdoms, Sayragal. In these fiefdoms, the tent-dwelling Turkmen warriors roamed at the expense of the settled rural and urban populations. Yet the early Safavid drive for territorial conquest and for conversion to Shi'ism also entailed a vision for a Persian imperial state, no matter how haphazardly it would be attained. Facing the Sunni foes. In the first decade of its creation, Ismail's nascent state replicated that of the Aghyanlus. Yet his vision of a universal empire emulated Timur's world-conquering ambitions of more than a century earlier. Despite Ismail's initial hesitation to march on Herat, by 1510, new incentives made him embark on an eastern campaign. The death of Sultan Hussein Bigara, reigned 1470 to 1506, a celebrated patron of Persian art and culture, whose domain for three decades had remained an island of urbane refinement, exposed the region to new nomadic incursions from further north. By 1500, already a large Uzbek contingent, under the leadership of Sheban or Shebani Khan, a descendant of Changiz Khan and founder of the Uzbek semi-nomadic kingdom, captured Samarkand, the capital of the eastern Timurids. They ravaged much of the region and caused havoc over greater Khorasan as far south as Merv in today's Turkmenistan, and Mashhad in northeastern Iran. The arrival of the Uzbeks, the latest wave of Turkic-Mongolian incursions into the interiors of Central Asia, posed a grave challenge to the security of the region. Sheban Khan, who saw himself as the legitimate heir to Changiz Khan, eventually managed to capture the prized city of Herat in 1507, putting an end to the last of the Timurid kingdoms. If Ismail needed any further motive to wage a war against Sheban, the capture of the city of Mashhad by the Uzbeks, the looting of the shrine of the 8th Shi'i Imam of its riches, and declaring the Safavid ruler a dangerous heretic, provided the pretext. In 1510, when he embarked on a campaign against Sheban in Marv, the ground for a Sunni-Shi'i showdown had already been laid. Whether it was an old ploy, luring the enemy into the interior before waging battle, or the inferiority of Uzbek forces to those of the Kezilbash, the Uzbeks were routed, and Sheban himself was trampled to death on the battlefield. The defeat of the Uzbeks was an important turning point. The capture of both Marv and Herat set limits on the eastern expansion of Safavid Iran, frontiers that remained essentially in place until the mid-19th century, despite many later Uzbek incursions. Ismail's half-hearted sorties after Herat to conquer Samarkand and beyond, however, proved futile. In contrast to Samarkand and Bukhara, which remained Sunni strongholds, Herat fully incorporated into the Safavid Empire, in part because of its earlier Shi'i Sufi proclivities, and as the eastern capital of the empire, vastly contributed to the shaping of Safavid culture. Ismail celebrated his victory with his typical cruelty. He turned the skull of Sheban Khan, his ideological adversary, into a gold-plated wine cup, witness to his long hours of heavy drinking. Sheban's dismembered right arm was sent off to Prince Zahir ad-Din Babur, the future founder of the Mughal Empire, who was then in control of Kabul. It was a symbolic reminder of Safavid reach. The reflective Timurid prince took heed and for a while collaborated with the Safavids against their common Uzbek enemy. He even pretended to be a Shi'i client of Ismail. Later he headed south to the less formidable tranquility of northern Hindustan. The stuffed skin of Sheban Khan's head also served as another carnal dispatch to the Ottoman Sultan Bayezid II, reigned 1481 to 1512. The heinous act, though not entirely outside the norms of the time, generated outrage in the Ottoman capital, reaffirming the perceptions of the Safavids as fierce heretics. The rest of Sheban's body was ritualistically devoured by a cannibal clan of the Gezilbash as proof of their devotion to their perfect guide. The Sunni dignitaries of Herat, Marv, and Balkh, who fell under Safavid rule soon after, did not fare any better at the hands of the Gezilbash army, which did not hesitate to massacre the defenceless or coerce them to Shi'ism. The Persian Tajik officials were no less merciful. Ismail's chief minister, Najma II, in 1513, after the fall of the Uzbek fortress of Karshi on the way to Bukhara, razed the fortress to the ground and reportedly massacred the entire Sunni population, including children and their domestic animals. He felt consoled, having retaliated for the massacres centuries earlier in his hometown Isfahan by Mongol and later by Timurid invaders. The news of Ismail's victory over the Uzbeks and consolidation in the east did not sit well with the Ottoman Sultan in Istanbul or with the Mamluk Sultan of Egypt and Syria. The Safavid movement had become a rallying point for the restive population of Anatolia and Upper Mesopotamia, whose territories were disputed among three powers. The triumphant prophet of Ardabil thus was a subject of reverence for many of the region's Shi'i Alawite population. Inspired by Safavid missionaries, the Turkmen communities of the Ottoman Empire, as far west as Konya in today's Turkey, were mobilized into a fervent messianic movement under Shah Goli Baba of the Takhelu tribe on the northeastern Mediterranean coast. Seeking to replicate Ismail's revolt, they rebelled against the Ottoman state and its provincial agents, perhaps in anticipation of a union with the Safavids. Shah Goli was killed in 1511, and the movement halted temporarily. Yet, even then, the Ottomans' anxiety over losing much of their Asian possessions was not eased. Nor was their hatred for Ismail diminished, even though he disowned Shah Goli and apologized to the Ottomans for the atrocities committed during the revolt. Facing the possibility of a mass Turkmen exodus into the Safavid realm, the Ottoman Sultan Bayezid II opted for conciliation, at least on the surface, and welcomed Ismail's gestures to establish good neighborly relations. Bayezid, despite a serious revolt from his own son Salim, who was critical of his father's policy of Safavid appeasement, nevertheless recognized Ismail as the legitimate ruler of Iran and tried in vain to strike some sense into his fervent head. He even addressed Ismail in his correspondence as heir to the kingdom of Khosrow, the legendary great king of the Shahnameh, and to Dahra, Darius, of the ancient Persian Empire. He further advised Ismail to behave royally, preserve his precious and strategically vital kingdom with justice and equanimity, end forced conversions, and leave in peace with his neighbors. The situation, however, changed dramatically in 1512. In stark contrast to his father, Salim I, reigned 1512 to 1520, who already had sensed the Safavid danger when he was governor of the Ottoman Black Sea provinces, left no room for compromise. There were many good reasons why Salim, who forced his father to abdicate, was labelled fierce, Turkish Yavuz, rendered in English as Salim the Grim. From the outset, he was determined not only to crush the remnant of the Shi'i resistance in Anatolia, but also to teach a lesson to, and possibly even eliminate, the reckless heretic Ismail, who, in his view, was exporting his Shi'i revolution to Ottoman lands. At the core of Salim's rage was his fear of a Safavid offensive from the east, an old concern of the Ottomans, who at the time were making new advances in the Balkans and Eastern Europe. A century earlier, in 1400, Timur's routing of the Ottoman defences in Bursa and his caging of the Ottoman Sultan for public display was a humiliating memory for a state that was founded on the idea of conquest. That the Ottoman Empire one day succumbed to the Shi'i propaganda in its heartland and even within its own military was an alarming possibility that was to be avoided at any cost. Disdainfully labelling Ismail as the Sufi kid and the Ardabil lad, and addressing him in official correspondence with obnoxious terms, Salim closed all negotiating channels with the Persian Shah. While preparing for his anti-Safavid campaign, the first and one of the most crucial of his short but tumultuous reign, he once more wrote to Ismail. Shortly before reaching the Iranian frontier, Salim called Ismail prince and the ruler of the Persian kingdom, the owner of the realm of oppression and tyranny, the master of sedition and commander of the rebels, the Darius of his time, and the Zahag of the age, equivalent of Cain. He further accused Ismail as having subjected the pure Mohammedan nation, may peace and greetings upon its founder, to his deceptive creed, and debunked the foundation of the solemn faith of Islam, hoisted the banners of tyranny by means of coercion, and encouraged his own wicked Shi'i followers to rape the chaste women and freely shed the blood of the dignitaries, destroyed mosques and built houses for idol worshipping, and called the luminous Quran a myth of the bygone times. Referring to the fatwa of the Sunni ulama denouncing Ismail, the Ottoman Sultan went on to say that, "Since the divine providence and the sacred destiny has placed in our mighty hands the prompt purging of that outright heresy, to abide by that crucial duty, we proceeded toward that land, Iran, so that by the thundering might of our triumphant sword we remove the thorny scrub that has grown in the stream of the lofty Sharia, and eradicate and cast away the invasive weeds that has so rapidly spread. He then warned the Safavid ruler to remove the cotton of neglect from the ear of vigilance, place the shroud on his shoulder, and be prepared, since, by the Quranic command of kill them whenever you encounter them, we are coming to ruin your fortune and leave not a single person on that land. Ismail's response to this furious declaration of war was dismissive, even cynical, and yet conciliatory. He sarcastically noted that he found his enemy's hostile tone, driven by courage and audacity, entertaining, yet he could not detect the source of hostility, since relations with Salim's late father, as Ismail claimed, was cordial. "The reason I have indeed spared your domain were twofold," he explained. "First, that the majority of the people of that realm are devout followers of my splendid ancestors. May the forgiving God place mercy upon them. Second, my respect for that warrior house, that is, the Ottomans, is old. We did not wish to impinge on that land a misfortune similar to the time of Timur. Indeed, we still don't wish it on you, and hence are not offended by such words. Why should we? Animosity among the kings is an old practice." He further intimated that all the inappropriate words in the letter should be treated as nothing but the withdrawal symptoms of the opium addict secretaries, whose daily doses were delayed. He even sent off, along with his friendly reply to Salim, a golden box of opium bearing the royal seal, in order to bring back soberness to the royal secretaries, who may have included, as Ismail's symbolic gift suggested, a number of Persian refugees to the Ottoman court. With an almost fatalistic tone, Ismail then admitted that though he was busy hunting around Isfahan, he had no choice but to start preparing for war. He ended with a well-known motto of Safavid propaganda, reflective of his own elusive self-confidence: "For long we tested in this punishing world. Whoever opposed the house of Ali was deposed." Salim's anti-Shi'i campaign began at home. After first preparing a meticulous register of the Turkmens of Anatolia, he carried out a systematic massacre of these presumed Safavid sympathizers throughout the region. The Ottoman forces reportedly killed 40,000 of the local inhabitants. The act of terror also involved atrocities, rape, enslavement of Shi'i women and children, and wholesale banishment of Shi'i villages to other provinces. The Ottoman Sunni jurists considered the massacre legitimate and even furnished the necessary license for an anti-Safavid campaign. The eternal reward for killing one Shi'i, a fatwa by the Mufti of Istanbul declared, was equal to killing 70 Christian infidels. In the spring campaign of 1514, one of the largest Ottoman armies was assembled under Selim's own gaze in Edirne, the old Ottoman capital on the European side. The Ottoman forces, the most advanced war machine of the time, consisted of 160,000 cavalry and infantry troops, of which 12,000 were the elite Janissary regiments. The multi-ethnic Ottoman army brought with it 200 cannon, 100 field guns, and well-maintained land and sea logistical lines via the Black Sea, including 8,000 camels and other beasts of burden. Ottoman military discipline and Salim's single-mindedness drove the advancing army to cover more than 900 miles, the entire length of Anatolia, in 4 months, arriving in July 1514 near the plain of Chaldiran in northwestern Azerbaijan, 50 miles northwest of the city of Khoi, where the decisive battle for the future of the region was waged. Salim, his grand vizier, and his commanders, those at least who survived his fits of rage and the many executions, encountered in Chaldiran a meagre Safavid cavalry force of less than 20,000. The remarkable imbalance should be attributed more to Ismail's inability to raise a larger force than to his mere miscalculation. The Ottoman campaign came at a time when the Safavids faced a renewed Uzbek incursion in Khorasan, a coordinated effort with the Ottomans, perhaps, to overwhelm the Safavids by forcing them to fight in two fronts. All along, Ismail was no doubt counting on Salim to change his mind, partly because of the difficult terrain and logistical obstacles on the way to the Iranian frontier, which indeed caused some discontent among the Janissaries. Moreover, in Ismail's view, there were no legitimate grounds for Ottoman belligerence. What was at stake, and what the Safavids' fate depended on it, was predominance in the struggle between the two powers, the imperial Sunni establishment with a vast and disciplined army versus a Shi'i revolutionary movement with a spirit of fatalistic nonchalance. Ismail must have harboured mixed feelings about how to respond to the Ottoman advance. His scorched earth tactics and refusal to give battle were well-tested methods of warfare designed to persuade the enemy to give up and return, a possibility surely enhanced by the inhospitable terrain of northwestern Iran. Yet, by late August, Ismail was almost forced to give battle in Khaldiran, for that was the last strategic line of defence before he would dangerously expose his capital, Tabriz, 120 miles to the east. His record of past victories might have made him overly confident about the superiority of the Gazilbash cavalry and its spirit of sacrifice on the battlefield, a fact that explains his lax preparation despite the glaring disparity in troop numbers. As a king prophet defending the cause of Ali and his sacred house, Ismail could not have doubted that divine providence would prevail. The fatalist strain running through Ismail's political life appeared strange even to his own Gazilbash lieutenants. Whether to overcome combat fright or out of sheer self-confidence, he and his Gazilbash chiefs spent the night before the battle drinking until dawn. On the morning of the fateful conflict, August 23, 1514, the drunkard Ismail began his day hunting quail on the adjacent plain, while his vanguard forces suffered heavy blows from Turkish artillery. Even when he joined his loyal Gazilbash troops, his sorties were a mix of valour and vagary rather than studied moves with clear strategic objectives. It is conceivable even that the daring quality of his warfare, which in the past had brought him much success, would have saved Ismail this time, were it not for the potency of Ottoman firepower, which the Safavids lacked. Even by 1514, the Safavids did not seem to have appreciated the decisive effectiveness of firepower, even though cannon had been employed in eastern Iran a quarter of a century earlier under the Timurids. Moreover, Ismail's own maternal grandfather, Azan Hasan, had been soundly defeated in 1473 by the Ottoman Sultan Muhammad II because he could not access the firearms that had been promised to him by his Venetian allies. The Safavid reluctance to use firearms may have been, as has often been noted, because they considered them unmanly and contrary to the chivalrous code of war. Ismail's Gazilbash devotees, believing they were shielded by the blessing of their prophet, were apparently bothered even less by the thunder of the cannon, at least before they saw them in action. Even when they did see the Ottoman cumbersome muzzle-loading arquebuses, the standard weapon of the Janissaries, and the heavy field guns, with their short range and inaccurate targeting, they did not seem to have been impressed. In fact, the effectiveness of the Ottoman artillery, perhaps the most advanced in the early 1500s, was mostly in siege warfare rather than on the battlefield, which may have encouraged the Safavids to face the enemy on the open plain rather than from within a walled fortress. At the outset, the Safavid hope for victory did not seem wholly misplaced. Under Ismail's command, the Safavid light cavalry, which was known for its agility and swift manoeuvring, embarked on an offensive that almost destroyed the Ottoman left flank. The advances on the right were also impressive, until the Ottoman cannon finally found the chance to fire. By the end of the day, the dual effects of the cannon thunder and shelling, perhaps more the former than the latter, shattered the Safavid defences. Ismail barely escaped captivity, but a number of Gazilbash chiefs and Safavid officials fell in the course of the battle or were captured. Also among the captives was Ismail's influential wife, Tajlu Khanum, who shortly afterward escaped from the Ottoman camp and rejoined her husband. The ancient Persian practice of bringing women to the battlefield, however, cost Ismail dearly. A favourite woman of his harem, Behruzeh Khanum, was captured and taken to Istanbul. There she was later married off as war booty to Salim's chief military judge. Despite Ismail's repeated pleas to Salim for her release, Behruzeh remained a hostage even after the chief military judge lost his head by order of the Sultan, presumably because he consummated the marriage, which was to have been only in name. For Ismail, the loss of Behruzeh was a personal humiliation no less than the loss in the battle. Remarkably, a number of women fought on the Iranian side, and a few were among the casualties, a reflection, perhaps, of the revolutionary perspective of the early Safavids that allowed the women to fight alongside the men. A number of Ottoman officials were also killed. The total number of casualties on both sides probably was no more than 5,000, of which more than two-fifths were the Turks. The capture of Tabriz shortly thereafter completed the humiliation and brought Safavid power to the verge of collapse. The prospect of a Janissary mutiny, however, saved the Safavid capital. Salim was obliged to abandon his original plan to winter in Tabriz, and, contrary to earlier Ottoman practice, he departed a week after his arrival in late summer of 1514, without leaving behind a single Ottoman contingent. He nevertheless stayed long enough to allow the city to be looted, and then rounded up and took to Istanbul a considerable number of artists, artisans, and merchants from Tabriz and elsewhere in the Safavid domains, including more than 12 painters, book illuminators, and calligraphers. They later established in Istanbul a Persian community of artists who would have a lasting influence on Ottoman fine arts. The consequences of the Battle of Khaldiran were far-reaching. The most immediate were a serious downturn in Safavid revolutionary zeal, and, along with it, a melancholic bend in Ismail's personality. The defeat was a severe blow to both the myth of his invincibility and the Gezil Bash's steadfast adherence to their sacred leader. It is from this point that the charismatic Safavid leadership gradually transformed into a traditional Persian kingship, a process that took several generations of Safavids to be completed. Moreover, the shock of defeat and the extinguishing of the apocalyptic faith laid firmer grounds for the Sharia-oriented creed promoted by the Safavid state and its contingent of jurists. A lurking doubt about the validity of his own mission must have convinced Ismail to never again take charge personally of any campaign, or, later on, to seriously contemplate a counter-offensive against the Ottomans, even though for a while he did make vengeance his rallying cry. He even named his young son, born after Khaldiran, Al-Ghas, from the Arabic Ghas, to retaliate. The Ottomans continued to consolidate in central and eastern Anatolia. At the obvious expense of the Safavids, they captured the key fortress of Kumah in central Anatolia in 1514. Ismail preferred not to risk another confrontation. It is quite possible that the Ottoman Sultan, despite his hasty departure from Tabriz, intended to revisit Iran and put an end to the Safavid heresy, perhaps with the ambition to at least partition Iran. In his correspondence with the Uzbek chief and the other archenemy of Ismail, Obeidullah Khan, who was the successor to the slain Sheban Khan, Salim had even proposed Isfahan at the heart of the Safavid domain as the rendezvous point for a coordinated pincer movement by the two Sunni armies. Although such an offensive never materialized, the dual Sunni threat on opposite flanks of Iran proper remained in place throughout the Safavid and post-Safavid periods. The exposure of the guarded domains of Iran to repeated aggressions on both sides, and the stretching, limited military resources did not subside before the beginning of the 19th century. Ottoman consolidation in Anatolia not only cost the Safavids direct loss of territory, but also removed their hopes for unhindered access to the Black Sea through an Anatolian enclave. For at least four centuries, the Safavids and their successors faced an Ottoman barrier that deprived them of direct political and commercial access to the Mediterranean world. Equally significant, the victory in Khaldiran stopped the expansion of the Shi'i Messianic Revolution. Although Alawite communities in Anatolia periodically revolted against the Ottomans during the Jalali revolts of the mid to late 16th century, for all intents and purposes, the War of 1514 eliminated any potential replication of a Safavid-like revolution there. The Shi'i state was, in effect, confined to Iran, while the Ottoman patronage of Sunni Islam further expanded throughout the Arab Middle East and beyond. Significantly, however, under Salim, and later under his son Suleiman, whose reign marked the zenith of Ottoman expansion, the Ottomans never succeeded in subordinating their Safavid neighbour. Despite punitive actions, long-term commercial blockages, sectarian belligerence, numerous invasions, and long periods of occupation of the western Iranian provinces, both the Safavids and their brand of Shi'ism persisted. In part, this was because of obstacles in maintaining secure logistical lines through Anatolia to Iran to establish effective control over hostile terrain. The Ottoman troops, especially the Janissaries, and the Ikinji light cavalry, moreover, harboured Bektashi Sufi Shi'i sympathies. Their reluctance to fight inside Iran became evident in a serious mutiny during the siege of Tabriz and later. For the most part, however, it was the religio-political synergy of the Safavids that helped them to resist Ottoman expansion, and, in due course, that fashioned Iran into a territorial empire with a distinct identity. Within the 3 years after Khaldiran, Salim secured eastern Anatolia and northern Mesopotamia, but also successfully shifted the direction of Turkish conquest toward the Mamluk lands. Such an enterprise proved easier to achieve and more materially beneficial. No phenomenon similar to the Safavids barred him from taking Damascus or even Cairo. By 1517, he had conquered the entire Mamluk territory in the Levantine Mediterranean, as well as Egypt and coastal North Africa. Ismail had little choice but to tread a cautious, even conciliatory path toward his powerful neighbour, who had come to dominate an empire that was far larger than his, as well as materially more prosperous and militarily more advanced.